over to his comrade and made several quick gestures, pointing to the north. Panamon shook his head in disgust. "The spineless mouse has been gone since early this morning, hours ago. Worse still, the fool fled northward, and it would not be healthy for us to chase him in that country. His own people will probably find him and dispose of him for us. They won't shelter a deserter." "Ah, let him go. We're better off without him, Shay. He was probably lying about the Sword of Shannara anyway." Shay nodded doubtfully, unconvinced that the gnome had been lying about everything he had told them. As unbalanced as the little fellow had seemed, he had nevertheless appeared certain that he knew where the sword could be found and who had possession of it. The whole idea that he knew such a secret was unnerving to the Veilman. Suppose he had gone after the sword. Suppose he knew where it was. "Forget the whole matter, Shay," Panamon interjected in resignation. "That gnome was scared to death of us. His only thought was to escape. The story of the sword was merely a trick to keep us from killing him until he found the opportunity to escape. Look at this. He left in such a hurry he even forgot his precious sack." For the first time, Shay noticed the sack lying partially open at the other side of the clearing. It was strange indeed that Oral Fane should abandon his treasures after going to so much trouble to persuade his captors to bring them along. That useless sack had been so important to him. And yet there it lay, forgotten, its contents still visible as small bulks beneath the cloth. Shay walked over to it curiously, staring at it with visible suspicion. He emptied the contents onto the forest earth, the swords and the daggers and the jewelry clattering together as they tumbled out in a heap. Shay stared at them, aware that the giant form of Kel'Thuzet was at his side, the dark, expressionless face bent next to his. They stood together, studying the gnome's abandoned hoard as if somehow it held a mysterious secret. Their companion watched for a few seconds, then muttered in disgust and strolled over to join them, glancing down at the weapons and jewelry. "Let's be on our way," he advised lightly. "We've got to find your friends, Shay, and perhaps with their help we can locate this elusive sword." "What are you staring at? You've already seen that worthless junk once. It hasn't changed." Then Shay saw it. "It's not the same," he announced slowly. "It's gone. He's taken it." "What's gone?" snapped Panamon irritably, kicking at the pile of junk. "What are you talking about?" "That old sword in the leather scabbard. The one with the arm and the torch." Panamon looked quickly at the swords in the little heap, frowning curiously. Kel'Thuzet straightened abruptly and looked at Shay with those deeply intelligent eyes fixed on the little Veilman. He realized the truth as well. "So he took one sword," Panamon growled without stopping to think. "That doesn't mean he..." He caught himself, his jaw dropping open in dismay, his eyes rolling back in disbelief. "Oh, no. That can't be. It can't. You mean he has..." He couldn't finish the thought, but choked on his words. Shay shook his head in quiet despair. "The Sword of Shannara." Chapter 21. The same morning that found Shay and his new companions facing the awful truth about the fleeing Oral Fane and the Sword of Shannara also found Alanon and the remaining members of the company embroiled in difficulties of their own. They had escaped from the Druid's Keep under the aged mystic's sure guidance, winding downward through the maze of tunnels in the core of the mountain to the forest land below. They had encountered no initial resistance to their escape, finding only a few scattered gnomes scurrying about the passages, remnants of the broken palace guard that had fled earlier. It was early evening by the time the little band was clear of the forbidding heights and moving northward through the forests. Alanon was certain that the gnomes had removed the Sword of Shannara from the keep some time before the encounter with the Skullbearer in the furnace room, but it was impossible to tell exactly when the removal had been accomplished. Eventine was patrolling the northern perimeter of Perenor, and any attempt to move the sword would be met with resistance from his soldiers. Perhaps the Elven King had already gained possession of the sword. Perhaps he had even intercepted the missing Shay. Alanon was extremely worried about the little Veilman, whom he had expected to find at the Druid's Keep. There had been no mistake when he had made his mental search for the youth back at the foot of the Dragon's Teeth. Shay was in the company of others, and they were moving northward toward Perenor. Something had diverted them. Still, Shay was a resourceful fellow, and he had the power of the Elfstones to protect him from the Warlock Lord. The Druid could only hope that somehow they would find each other without further complications, and that when they did, Shay would be safe and unharmed. Alanon had other worries, however, which demanded his immediate attention. Gnome reinforcements began to arrive in large numbers, and it did not take them long to conclude that Alanon and his little band of invaders had fled the castle and were somewhere in the dangerous, impregnable forest surrounding Perenor. In truth, the gnomes had no idea for whom they were searching. They only knew that the castle had been invaded, and the intruders had to be captured or destroyed. The emissaries of the Warlock Lord had not arrived, and the Skull King himself did not yet realize his prey had escaped him once again. He rested contentedly in the dark recesses of his domain, assured that the troublesome Alanon had been destroyed in the furnaces of Perenor, that the heir of Shannara and the others with him were prisoners, and that the Sword of Shannara was safely on its way to the Northland, intercepted by this time by a Skullbearer whom he had dispatched a day earlier, to be certain the precious sword was not retaken. So the newly arrived gnomes began to comb the forests surrounding Perenor in an effort to find the unknown intruders, believing that they would flee south and sending the majority of their hunters in that direction. Alanon and his small band were moving steadily northward, but progress was slowed from time to time with the appearance of large gnome search parties patrolling the woodlands. The little company would never have escaped undetected had they proceeded south. But the enemy numbers were reduced enough to the north that they managed to elude the hunting parties by hiding until they had passed, and then pressing onward. It was light by the time they finally reached the fringes of the forest and could look northward over the awesome plains of Strelaheim, their pursuers momentarily behind them. Alanon turned to them, his dark countenance worn and grim, but the eyes still bright with determination. His companions waited as he studied them, one by one, as if he were seeing each for the first time. Finally he spoke, the words slow and reluctant. "We have reached the end of the road, my friends. The journey to Perenor is at an end, and it is time for the company to disband, and each of us to go his own way. We have lost our chance to gain possession of the sword, at least for the moment. Shay is still missing, and we cannot tell how long it may take to find him. But the greatest threat facing us is an invasion from the north. We must protect ourselves and the peoples of the lands, south, east, and west of us, from that. We have seen no sign of the elven armies of Eventine, though they were supposed to be patrolling this region. It appears they have been withdrawn, and this would only be done if the Warlock Lord had begun to move his armies southward. Then the invasion has begun, Balinor asked shortly. Alanon nodded solemnly, and the others exchanged startled looks. Without the sword we cannot defeat the Warlock Lord, so we must attempt to stop his armies. To do this, we must unite the free nations quickly. We may already be too late. Brona will use his armies to seize all of the central Southland. To do this, he need only destroy the border legion of Callahorn. Balinor, the legion must hold the cities of Callahorn to give the nations enough time to unite their armies and strike back at the invader. Durin and Dale can accompany you to Tirsis and from there travel westward to their own land. Eventine must bring his elven armies across the plains of Strelaheim to reinforce Tirsis. If we lose there, the warlock lord will have succeeded in driving a wedge between the armies, and there will be little chance of uniting them. Worse still, the entire Southland will lie open and unprotected. Men will never be able to form their armies in time. The Border Legion of Callahorn is the only chance they have. Balinor nodded in agreement and turned to Hendel. What support can the dwarves give us? The city of Arfleet is the key to the eastern sector of Callahorn. Hendel pondered the situation carefully. My people must protect against any assault through the Anar, but we can spare enough men to help defend Varfleet as well. But you must hold the cities of Kern and Tirsis yourself. The elven armies will help you on the west, Durin promised quickly. Wait a minute, exclaimed Menyon incredulously. What about Shay? You've kind of forgotten about him, haven't you? Still allowing your words to precede your thinking, I see, Alanon said darkly. Menyon turned scarlet with anger, but waited to see what the mystic had to say. I'm not abandoning the search for my brother, Flick announced quietly. Nor am I suggesting you should, Flick. Alanon smiled at the other's concern. You and Menyon and I shall continue to search for our young friend and for the missing sword. I suspect that where we find one, we shall find the other. Remember the words spoken to me by the Shade of Bremen. Shay shall be the first to lay hands on the sword of Shannara. Perhaps he has already done so. Then let's get on with the search, suggested Menyon irritably, avoiding the eyes of the druid. We shall leave now, Alanon announced, adding pointedly, but you must see that you keep a closer guard over your tongue. A prince of Lee should speak with wisdom and foresight, with patience and understanding, not with foolish anger. Menyon nodded grudgingly. The seven said their farewells with mixed emotions and parted. Balinor, Hendel, and the elven brothers turned westward past the forest in which Shay and his companions had spent the night, hoping to circle the impregnable forest and pass down through the hill country north of the Dragon's Teeth and thereby reach Kern and Tirsis within 2 days. Alanon and his two youthful companions moved eastward, searching for some sign of Shay. Alanon was convinced that the Veilman must have eventually come northward toward Perenor, and perhaps was a prisoner in one of the gnome camps in that region. Rescuing him would not be easy, but the druid's greatest fear was that the warlock lord would learn of his capture and find out who he was, then have him immediately executed. If that happened, the sword of Shannara would be worthless to them anyway, and they would have no choice but to rely on the strength of the divided armies of the three besieged lands. It was not a promising thought, and Alanon quickly turned his attention to the land ahead. Menyon walked slightly in front as they traveled, his keen eyes picking out the trails and studying the footprints of all who had passed. His concern was the weather. If it rained, they would never find the trail. Even if the weather stayed favorable for them, the sudden windstorms that blew across the Strelaheim would have the same effect as a rainfall, erasing all traces of anyone's passage. Flick, dutifully bringing up the rear, walked in abject silence, hoping against hope that they would find some sign of Shay, but fearful that he had seen the last of his brother. By noonday, the barren plains were shimmering with the blistering heat of the white-hot sun, and the three travelers walked as close to the forest edge as possible to take advantage of small patches of shade from the great trees. Al-Anon alone seemed unperturbed by the fearful heat, his dark face calm and relaxed in the scorching sunlight, free from even the slightest trace of perspiration. Flick felt ready to collapse at any moment, and even the durable Menyon Lee was beginning to feel ill. His sharp eyes were dry and blurred, and his senses were starting to play tricks on him. He was seeing things that weren't there, hearing and smelling images formed by his muddled brain in the seething flatlands ahead. At last the two Southlanders could go no farther, and their tall leader called a brief halt, leading them into the cooling shade of the forest. In silence they ate a small, tasteless meal of bread and dried meats. Flick wanted to ask the druid more about Shay's chances of surviving alone in that desolate land, but he couldn't bring himself to voice the questions. The answers were all too apparent. He felt strangely alone now that the others were gone. He had never felt close to Al-Anon, always plagued by nagging doubts about the druid's strange powers. The mystic remained a giant, shadowy figure, as mysterious and deadly as the skull-bearers that pursued them so relentlessly. He remained a personification of the deathless spirit of Bremen that had risen from the netherworld in the Valley of Shale. He was power and wisdom of such magnitude that he didn't seem a part of Flick's mortal world. He was more a part of the Warlock Lord's domain. That black, frightful corner of the mortal mind where fear is master and reason cannot penetrate. Flick could not forget the terrible battle between the great mystic and the treacherous skull creature which had resulted in a fiery climax in the flames of the furnace beneath the druid's keep. Yet Al-Anon had saved himself. He had survived what no other man could have survived. It was more than merely uncanny. It was terrifying. Balinor alone had seemed able to deal with the giant leader, but now he was gone, and Flick felt very alone and vulnerable. Menyon Lee felt even less certain of himself. He was not really afraid of the powerful druid, but he was aware that the giant did not think much of him and had brought him along primarily because Shay had wanted him. Shay had believed in the Prince of Lee when even Flick had doubted the adventurer's motives. But Shay was gone now. Menyon felt he had only to anger the druid once more, and the unpredictable mystic would dispose of him for good. So he ate quietly and said nothing, believing that for the moment discretion was the better part of valor. When the silent meal was concluded, the druid motioned them to their feet. Again they marched eastward along the fringes of the forest, their faces bathed in the withering heat of the sun, their tired eyes scanning the barren plains for the missing Shay. This time they walked for only 15 minutes before they found signs of something out of the ordinary. Menyon spotted the tracks almost immediately. A large number of gnomes had passed that way several days earlier, booted and undoubtedly armed. They followed the tracks northward for about half a mile. Upon topping a small rise of ground, they found the remains of the gnomes and elves who had died in battle. The decaying bodies lay where they had fallen, still untouched and unburied, less than 100 yards from the rise. The three walked slowly down into the graveyard of bleached bones and rotting flesh, the terrible stench rising to their nostrils in sickening waves. Flick could go no farther, and stopped where he was to watch the other two walk into the midst of the dead bodies. Al-Anon wandered in silent contemplation through the fallen men, studying discarded weapons and standards, glancing only briefly at the dead. Menyon discovered a fresh set of tracks almost immediately and began moving mechanically about the battlefield, his eyes fixed on the dusty earth. Flick could not tell exactly what was going on from his distant vantage point, but it appeared that the Highlander retraced his own steps several times, casting about for traces of new trails, the thin hands shading his reddened eyes. Finally, he turned southward toward the forest and began strolling slowly back toward Flick, his head lowered thoughtfully. He stopped at a large clump of bushes and dropped to one knee, apparently observing something of interest. Momentarily forgetting his distaste for the battlefield and its corpses, the curious veilman hastened forward. He had just reached the kneeling man's side when Al-Anon, standing in the center of the battlefield, let out a shout of astonishment. The two men paused and watched silently while the tall black figure peered downward for a moment as if to be certain, then turned and moved toward them in long strides. The mystic's dark face was flushed with excitement when he reached them, and they were relieved to see the familiar mocking smile slowly spread into a wide grin. "Amazing! It is amazing indeed! Our young friend is more resourceful than I had imagined. Up there I found a small pile of ashes, all that remains of one of the skull-bearers. Nothing mortal destroyed that creature. It was the power of the Elfstones." "Then Shay has been here ahead of us," exclaimed Flick hopefully. "No other has the power to use the stones," Al-Anon nodded assuringly. "There are signs of a terrific battle, tracks that show Shay was not alone. But I cannot tell whether those who were with him were friends or enemies. Nor can I tell if the creature of the North was destroyed during or after the battle between gnome and elf. What have you found, Highlander?"
"A lot of false trails left by a very intelligent troll," Menyon responded wryly. "It's impossible for me to tell much from all the footprints, but I am sure that a large rock troll was among the prior occupants of this field. He left his tracks all over it, but none of them lead anywhere. There are indications that some sort of scuffle took place within these bushes, though. See the bent branches and newly fallen leaves? But more important, there are footprints of a small man. They could be Shay's.
Do you think he was captured by the troll?" Flick queried fearfully.
Menyon smiled at his concern and shrugged.
"If he could handle one of those skull creatures, then I doubt he would have much trouble with an ordinary troll. The elf stones are no protection against mortal creatures," Al-Anon pointed out chillingly. "Is there any clear indication which way this troll went?"
Menyon shook his head negatively.
"To be certain, we would have had to find the tracks right away. These tracks are at least a day old. The troll knew what he was doing when he left. We could search forever and never be sure which way he went."
Flick felt his heart sink at this news. If Shay had been taken by this mysterious creature, then it appeared they had reached another dead end.
"I found something else," Al-Anon announced after a moment. "I found a broken standard from the House of Elicidal, Eventine's personal banner. He may have been present at the battle. He may have been taken prisoner or even killed. It seems possible that the slain gnomes were attempting to escape from Paranor with the sword, and were intercepted by the elf king and his warriors. If so, then Eventine, Shay, and the sword may all be in the hands of the enemy."
"I'm sure of one thing," Menyon declared quickly. "Those troll footprints and this battle in the bushes took place yesterday, while the battle between the gnomes and elves is several days old."
"Yes. Yes, you're right, of course," the druid agreed thoughtfully. "There has been a sequence of events taking place that we can't piece together from the little we know. I'm afraid we won't find all the answers here."
"What do we do now?" Flick asked anxiously.
"There are tracks leading westward across the Strelaheim," Al-Anon mused thoughtfully, gazing in that direction as he spoke. The tracks are blurred, but they may have been made by survivors of this battle.
He looked questioningly at the silent Menyon Lee for his opinion.
Our mysterious troll did not go that way, Menyon stated worriedly. He would not bother with a lot of false trails if he were going to leave a clear one when he left.
I don't like it.
Do we have any choice? Alanon persisted. The only clear set of tracks leaving this battleground leads westward. We'll have to follow them and hope for the best.
Flick thought that such optimism was unwarranted in view of the hard facts of the situation, and found the comments out of character for the grim druid. Still, it seemed they had little choice in the matter. Perhaps whoever had made those tracks could tell them something about Shay. The little Veilman turned to Menyon and nodded his willingness to follow the druid's advice, noting the look of consternation clouding the Highlander's lean features. Clearly, Menyon was not happy with the decision, convinced that there was another trail to be found that would tell them more about the troll and the slain skull creature. Alanon beckoned to them, and retracing their steps, they began the long march back across the Strelaheim Plains to the lands west of Perenor. Flick cast one final look at the field of slain men, their carcasses rotting slowly in the boiling heat of the sun, shunned by man and nature in senseless death. He shook his broad head. Perhaps this was the way it would end for them all. The three travelers walked steadily westward for the remainder of the day. They spoke little, lost in private thoughts, their eyes following almost carelessly the blurred trail before them as they watched the brilliant sun turn red in the horizon and die into evening. When it was too dark to continue, Alanon directed them into the bordering forests where they made camp for the night. The trio had reached a point near the northwestern sector of the dreaded impregnable forest, and they were once again in danger of discovery by gnome hunting parties or prowling wolf packs. The resolute druid explained that while they were in some danger of discovery, he believed the search for them would have been abandoned by this time in favor of more urgent matters. As a necessary precaution, they would light no fire and would keep constant watch through the night for the wolves. Flick silently prayed that the wolf packs would not venture this close to the plainland, but would keep to the dark interior of the woods, closer to the druid's keep. They ate a brief, tasteless meal and quickly turned in for the night. Menyon offered to stand the first watch. Flick was asleep in moments, but it seemed he had slept for only an instant when the Highlander awoke him for his turn as guard. About midnight, Alanon approached without a sound and ordered Flick to go back to sleep. The Veilman had been guarding for only about an hour, but he did as he was told without arguing. When Flick and Menyon awoke again, it was dawn. In the faint red and yellow slivers of sunlight which crept slowly into the shadowed forest, they saw the giant druid resting peacefully against a tall elm as he stared at them. The tall, dark figure seemed almost a part of the forest, sitting there motionlessly, the deep eyes black in the caverns beneath the great brow. They knew that Alanon must have stood guard over them all night without sleep. It seemed impossible that he could be rested, yet he rose without stretching, the grim face relaxed and alert. They ate a quick breakfast and marched out of the forest onto the Strelaheim once more. A moment later they halted in shocked disbelief. All about them the skies were clear and faintly blue in the new light of day, the sun rising in blinding brilliance above the mountain ranges far to the east. But to the north stood a gigantic, towering wall of darkness against the skyline, as if all the ominous thunder clouds of the earth had been massed together and piled one on top of the next to form a black wall of gloom. The wall rose into the air until it was lost in the curving atmosphere of the earth's horizon, and it stretched across all of the rugged Northland, huge, dark,
and terrible. Its center, the kingdom of the warlock lord. It seemed to foreshadow the relentless, inevitable approach of an endless night.
What do you make of that?
Menyon could barely get the question out.
For a moment, Alanon said nothing, his own dark face mirroring the blackness of the northern wall as he stared in silence. The muscles of his lean jaw seemed to tighten beneath the small black beard, and the eyes narrowed as if deep in concentration.
Menyon waited quietly, and at last the druid seemed to realize he had spoken, turning to him in recognition.
It is the beginning of the end. Brona has signaled the start of his conquest. That terrible darkness will follow his armies as they sweep southward, then east and west until the whole earth is blanketed. When the sun is gone in all the lands, freedom is dead too.
Are we beaten? Flick asked after a moment. Are we really beaten? Is it hopeless for us, Alanon?
His worried voice struck a responsive chord within the giant druid, who turned quietly to him, gazing reassuringly into the wide, frightened eyes.
Not yet, my young friend. Not yet.
Alanon led them westward for several hours from that point, staying close to the fringes of the forest, warning Menyon and Flick to keep their eyes open for any sign of the enemy. The skull-bearers would be flying in the day as well as by night, now that the warlock lord had begun his conquest, no longer afraid of the sunlight, no longer trying to conceal their presence. The master was finished with hiding in the Northland. Now he would begin to move into the other lands, sending his faithful spirits ahead of him like great birds of prey. He would give them the power they needed to withstand the sun, the power he had harnessed in the great dark wall that shadowed his kingdom and would soon begin to shadow all of the lands beyond. The days of light were drawing to a close. About mid-morning, the three travelers turned southward on the Strelaheim Plains, keeping close to the western fringes of the forests surrounding Perenor. The tracks they had been following merged at this point with others coming down from the north to continue southward toward Callahorn. The trail they left was broad and open. There had been no attempt to hide either their number or their direction. From the width of the trail and the impressions left by the footprints, Menyon concluded that at least several thousand men had passed this way a few days earlier. The footprints were gnome and troll, obviously part of the Northland hordes of the warlock lord. Alanon was certain now that a giant army was massing on the plains above Callahorn to begin a sweep through the Southland that would divide the free lands and their armies. The trail had become so obscured by the intermingling of constant additional parties into the main body that it was no longer possible to tell whether a small group might have detached itself. Shay or the sword could have been taken a different way at some point, and his friends would fail to catch it, continuing to follow the main army. They walked southward all day with only occasional periods of rest, intent on catching the huge column of men ahead before nightfall. The trail of the invading army was so apparent that Menyon merely glanced out of habit from time to time at the trampled earth. The barren plains of Strelaheim were replaced by green grasslands. To Flick, it almost seemed that they were going home again, and the familiar hills of Shady Vale might be just over the rise of the plains. The weather was warm and humid, and the terrain was considerably more friendly. They were still some distance from Callahorn, but it was clear that they were passing out of the bleakness of the Northland into the warmth and greenness of their home. The day passed quickly, and conversation between the travelers resumed. At Flick's urging, Alanon told them more about the Council of the Druids.
He recounted in detail the history of man since the Great Wars, explaining how their race had progressed to its present state of existence. Minion said little, content to listen to the druid and keep a close watch over the surrounding countryside. When they had begun the day's march, the sun had been bright and warm, and the sky clear. By mid-afternoon, the weather had changed abruptly, and the brightness of the sun was replaced by low-hanging gray rain clouds and an even more humid atmosphere that clung uncomfortably to the exposed skin. The air felt sticky and wet, and there was little doubt that a storm was approaching. They were near the southernmost boundaries of the impregnable forest by this time, and the jagged peaks of the dragon's teeth were visible in the dark horizon to the south. Still, there was no sign of the massive army traveling ahead of them, and Menyon was beginning to wonder how far south it might have already penetrated. They were not far now from the borders of Callahorn, which lay immediately below the dragon's teeth. If the Northland armies had already taken Callahorn, then the end had indeed come. The gray light of the afternoon dropped off sharply and the sky closed over in sullen darkness. It was dusk when they first heard the ominous booming rising out of the night, echoing off the giant peaks ahead of them. Menyon recognized it at once. He had heard that sound before in the forests of the Anar. It was the sound of hundreds of gnome drums, their steady rhythm throbbing through the stillness of the humid air, filling the night with a sinister tension. The earth shook with the force of the beat, and all life had gone mute in awe and fear. Menyon could tell by the intensity of the drums that there were far more than they had encountered at the Pass of Jade. If the army of the Northland could be measured by the sound of those drums, then there must be thousands. As the three moved quickly ahead, the frightening sound enveloped them entirely, booming all around them in shuddering echoes. The gray clouds of late afternoon still masked the night sky, leaving the searching men shrouded in inky darkness. Menyon and Flick could no longer find the way alone, and the silent druid led them with uncanny precision into the rough lowlands below Paranor. No one spoke, each man frozen into watchful apprehension by the deathly booming of those gnome drums. They knew that the enemy camp was just ahead. Then the terrain changed abruptly from the low hills and scattered brush to steep slopes dotted with boulders and treacherous rock ledges. The sure-footed Alanon moved steadily ahead, his tall form unmistakable even in the near blackness, and the two Southlanders followed dutifully. Menyon estimated that they must have reached the smaller mountains and foothills just above the dragon's teeth, and that Alanon had chosen to come this way to avoid any chance encounters with members of the Northland army. It was still impossible to tell where the enemy army was encamped, but from the sound of the drums it seemed as if they were right on top of it. The three dark shapes wound their way cautiously through the night for what must have been almost an hour, at times feeling their way blindly through the boulders and brush. Their clothes were scraped and torn, their exposed limbs scratched and bruised, but the silent druid did not slacken the pace or pause to rest. At the end of that long hour's time, he halted abruptly and turned to them, placing a warning finger over pursed lips. Then slowly, cautiously, he led them forward into a huge mass of boulders. For several minutes, the three climbed noiselessly upward. Suddenly, there were lights in the distance, dim, flickering yellow lights that came from burning fires. They crawled on hands and knees to the rim of the boulders. Upon reaching a tilted shelf of rock that sloped upward to the edge of the boulder cluster, they raised their heads slowly to the rim and peered breathlessly over. What they saw was awesome and terrifying. As far as the eye could see, stretching miles in all directions, the fires of the Northland army burned in the night. They were like thousands of blazing yellow dots in the blackness of the plains, and moving busily about in their bright light were the dim shapes of wiry, gnarled gnomes and bulky, thick-limbed trolls. There were thousands of them, all armed, all waiting to descend on the kingdom of Calahorn. It was inconceivable to Menyon and Flick that even the legendary Border Legion could hope to stand against such a mighty force. It was as if the entire gnome and troll population had been gathered on the plains below. Alanon had avoided any chance encounters with scouts or guards by approaching along the edges of the Dragon's Teeth on the western borders, and now the three were perched in a crow's nest of boulders several hundred feet up from the army encamped below. From this height, the shocked Southlanders could see the entirety of the massive force assembled to invade their poorly defended homeland. The drums of the gnomes boomed out in steady crescendo as the men stared down, their eyes traveling from one end of the sprawled camp to the other in disbelief. For the first time, they understood fully what they were up against. Before, it had been only Alanon's words describing the invasion. Now they could see the enemy and judge for themselves. Now they could feel the desperate need for the mysterious Sword of Shannara, a need for the one power that could destroy the evil being who had caused this army to materialize and march against them. But now was already too late. For several long minutes, no one said anything as they stared down at the enemy encampment. Then Menyon touched Alanon on the shoulder and started to speak, but the druid clamped his hand quickly over the surprised Highlander's mouth and pointed toward the base of the slope on which they lay concealed. Menyon and Flick peered cautiously downward, and to their surprise, they made out the vague shapes of gnome guards patrolling near the base of their hiding place. Neither had believed the enemy would bother to place guards this far from the actual camp, but apparently they were taking no chances. Alanon motioned for the two to move back from the ledge of the boulders, and they quickly complied, following his lead as he inched his way down into the tall rocks. Once they had reached the bottom of the boulder cluster, safely away from the rim of the ledge, the druid huddled together with them in earnest counsel. "We have to be very quiet," he warned in a tense whisper. "The sound of our voices would have echoed off the cliff face onto the plains from up there. Those gnome guards would have heard us." Menyon and Flick nodded in understanding. "The situation is more serious than I thought," Alanon continued, his voice a hushed rasp in the gloom. "It appears the entire Northland army has bunched at this one point to strike at Calahorn. Brona intends to crush any resistance from the Southland immediately, dividing the better prepared armies of the East and West so he can deal with them separately. The Evil One already holds everything north of Calahorn. Balinor and the others must be warned." He paused a moment, then turned expectantly to Menyon Lee.
"I can't leave now," Menyon exclaimed heatedly. "I've got to help you find Shay."
"We haven't the time to argue the priorities of the situation," Alanon declared almost menacingly, one finger coming up like a dagger at the Highlander's face. "If Balinor is not warned about the situation, Calahorn will fall, and the rest of the Southland will follow, including Lee. The time has come for you to start thinking about your own people. Shay is only one man, and right now there is nothing you can do for him. But there is something you can do for the thousands of Southlanders who face enslavement at the hands of the Warlock Lord if Calahorn should fall." Alanon's voice was so cold that Flick could feel the chills run up his spine. He could sense Menyon tensing expectantly, fearfully at his side. But the Prince of Lee kept silent in the face of this stinging reprimand. Druid and Prince faced one another in the darkness for several interminable minutes, their eyes locked in open anger.
Then Menyon looked away abruptly and nodded shortly. Flick breathed an audible sigh of relief.
"I'll go to Callahorn and warn Balinor," Menyon muttered, his voice still muffled with fury. "But I'll be back to find you."
"Do as you wish when you have found the others," replied Alanon coldly. "However, any attempt to return through enemy lines would be foolhardy at best. Flick and I shall try to find out what has happened to Shay and the sword. We will not desert him, Highlander. I promise you."
Menyon looked back at him sharply, almost in disbelief, but the druid's eyes were clear and undisguised. He was not lying.
"Keep close to these smaller mountains until you get past the enemy picket lines," the giant wanderer advised quietly. "When you reach the Myrmidon River above Kern, cross there and enter the city before dawn. I expect the Northland army will march on Kern first. There is little chance the city can be successfully defended against a force of that size. The people should be evacuated and moved into Tirsis before the invaders can cut off their retreat. Tirsis is built on a plateau against the back of a mountain. Properly defended, it can withstand any assault for at least several days. That should be time enough for Durin and Dale to reach their homeland and return with the Elven army. Hendel should be able to offer some help from the Eastland. Perhaps Callahorn can be held long enough to mobilize and combine the armies of the three lands to strike back at the Warlock Lord. It is the only chance we have without the Sword of Shannara."
Menyon nodded in understanding and turned to Flick, extending his hand in a gesture of farewell. Flick smiled faintly and clasped the hand warmly.
"Good luck to you, Menyon Lee."
Alanon came forward and placed a strong hand on the Highlander's lean shoulder.
"Remember, Prince of Lee, we depend on you. The people of Callahorn must be made aware of the danger they face. If they falter or hesitate, they are lost, and with them all of the Southland. Do not fail."
Menyon turned abruptly and moved like a shadow into the rocks beyond. The giant druid and the little veilman stood silently as the lean figure flitted agilely between the rocks and then disappeared from sight. They stood for a few minutes without speaking after he was gone, and then Alanon turned to Flick.
"To us is left the task of finding out what has happened to Shay and the sword."
He spoke again in a lowered voice, sitting heavily down on a small rock. Flick moved closer to him.
"I'm worried about Eventime as well. That broken standard we found back at the battlefield was his personal banner. He may have been taken prisoner, and if he has, the Elven army may hesitate to act until he has been rescued. They love him too dearly to take a chance with his life, even to save the Southland."
"You mean the Elven people don't care what happens to the people of the Southland?" Flick exclaimed incredulously. "Don't they know what will happen to them should the Southland fall to the Warlock Lord?"
"It's not quite as simple as it seems," Alanon stated, sighing deeply. "Those who follow Eventine understand the danger, but there are others who believe that the Elven people should stay out of the affairs of the other lands, unless they are directly attacked or threatened. With Eventine absent, the choice will not be so clear, and discussion of what is right and proper may delay any move by the Elven army until it is too late for them to help."
Flick nodded slowly, thinking of another time at Cullhaven when a bitter Hendel had reported much the same thing about the people of the Southland cities. It seemed incredible that people could be so undecided and confused in the face of such obvious danger. Yet Shay and he had been like that when they had first learned about Shay's birthright and the threat of the Skullbearers. It was not until they had seen one crawling, searching for them.
"I've got to know what's happening in that camp," Al-Anon's voice cut into Flick's thoughts with a sharp rasp of determination. He paused in thought a moment, staring at the little veilman. "My young friend Flick." He smiled faintly in the darkness. "How would you like to be a gnome for a little while?"
Chapter 22. With Shay still missing somewhere north of the Dragon's Teeth, and Al-Anon, Flick, and Menyon in search of some definite sign of his whereabouts, the remaining four members of the now-divided company of friends drew within sight of the great towers of the fortress city of Tirsis. It had taken them almost 2 days of constant travel, their hazardous journey through the lines of the Northland army further impeded by the formidable mountain barrier cutting off the Southland kingdom of Callahorn from the land of Paranor. The first day was long, but without incident, as the four wound southward through the forests adjoining the gnome-patrolled impregnable forest to reach the lowlands beyond, which formed the doorstep to the awesome Dragon's Teeth. The mountain passes were all carefully guarded by gnome hunters, and it seemed it would prove to be impossible to get past them without a fight. But a simple ruse lured most of the guards away from the entrance to the high, winding Kennan Pass, allowing the four an opportunity to get into the mountains. The difficult task of getting out again at the southern end was accomplished only after several gnomes were silently dispatched at a midpoint check camp, and 20 more were frightened into believing the entire border legion of Callahorn had seized the pass and was descending on the luckless sentries with every intention of killing them all. Hendel was laughing so hard when they finally reached the safety of the forests south of the Kennan Pass that all four were forced to pause momentarily until he could recover his composure. Durin and Dale looked doubtfully at one another, recalling the taciturn dwarf's grim attitude during the journey to Paranor. They had never seen him laugh at anything, and somehow it seemed out of character. They shook their lean faces in disbelief and glanced questioningly at Balinor. But the giant borderman only shrugged. He was an old friend to Hendel, and the dwarf's changeable character was well known to him. It was good to hear his laughter again. Now in the twilight of the early evening, with the sun's fading light a hazy purple and red in the vast horizon of the western plains, the four stood within sight of their destination. Their bodies were worn and sore, their normally keen minds numbed by lack of sleep and constant travel, but their spirits rose with unspoken excitement at the sight of the majestic city of Tirsis. They paused for an instant at the edge of the forests that ran south from the Dragon's Teeth through Callahorn. To the east was the city of Varfleet, which guarded the only sizable passage through the Mountains of Rhoom, a small range that lay above the fabled Rainbow Lake. The sluggish Myrmidon River wound its way through the forest at their backs above Tirsis. Westward lay the smaller island city of Kern, and the source of the river was farther west in the vast emptiness of the Strelaheim Plains. The river was broad at all points, forming a natural barrier against any would-be enemy and offering reliable protection for the inhabitants on the island. While the river ran full, which it did almost the year around, the waters were deep and swift, and no enemy had ever taken the island city. Yet while both Kern, surrounded by the waters of the Myrmidon, and Varfleet, nestled in the mountains of Rune, seemed formidable and well defended, it was the ancient city of Tirsis that harbored the Border Legion, the precision fighting machine that had for countless generations successfully guarded the borders of the Southland against invasion. It was the Border Legion that had always taken the brunt of any assault against the race of man, offering the first line of defense against an enemy invader. Tirsis had given birth to the Border Legion of Callahorn, and as a fortress it was without equal. The old city of Tirsis had been destroyed in the first War of the Races, but had been rebuilt and then expanded over the years until now it was one of the largest cities in all the Southland and by far the strongest city standing in the northern regions. It had been designed as a fortress capable of withstanding any enemy attack.
a bastion of towering walls and jagged ramparts set on a natural plateau against the face of an unscalable cliff. Each generation of its citizens had contributed in the construction of the city, each making it more formidable. Over 700 years ago, the great outer wall had been built on the edge of the plateau, extending the boundaries of Tirsis as far as nature would permit on the bluff face. In the fertile plains below the fortress were the farms and croplands that fed the city, the dark earth nurtured and sustained by the life-giving waters of the great Myrmidon which ran east and south. The people had their homes scattered throughout the surrounding countryside, relying on the city's walled protection only in the event of invasion. For hundreds of years following the First War of the Races, the cities of Calahorn had successfully repelled assaults by unfriendly neighbors. None of the three had ever been seized by an enemy. The famed Border Legion had never been defeated in battle. But Calahorn had never faced an army the size of that sent by the Warlock Lord. The real test of strength and courage lay ahead. Balinor looked upon the distant towers of his city with mixed feelings. His father had been a great king and a good man, but he was growing old. For years he had commanded the Border Legion in its unceasing battle against persistent gnome raiders from the Eastland. Several times he had been forced to wage long and costly campaigns against the great Northland trolls when scattered tribes had moved into his land, intent on seizing its cities and subjugating its people. Balinor was the elder son and the logical heir to the throne. He had studied hard under his father's careful guidance, and he was well liked by the people. People whose friendship could be won only through respect and understanding. He had worked beside them, fought beside them, and learned from them, so that now he could feel what they felt and look through their eyes. He loved the land enough to fight to hold it, as he was doing now, as he had been doing for a number of years. He commanded a regiment of the Border Legion, and they wore his personal insignia, a crouched leopard. They were the key unit of the entire fighting force. For Balinor, holding their respect and devotion was more important than anything. He had been gone from them for months now. Gone, by his own choosing, to a self-imposed exile of travel with the mysterious Alanon and the company from Cullhaven. His father had asked him not to go, pleaded with him to reconsider his decision. But he had already decided. He was not to be swayed, even by his father. His brow furrowed, and a strange feeling of gloom settled into his mind as he looked down on his homeland. Unconsciously, he raised one gloved hand to his face, the cold chainmail tracing the line of the scar that ran down the exposed right cheek to his chin. "Thinking about your brother again," Hendel asked, although it was not so much a question as a statement of fact. Balinor looked over at him, momentarily startled, then nodded slowly. "You've got to stop thinking about that whole business, you know," the dwarf stated flatly. "He could be a real threat to you if you persist in thinking of him as a brother, and not as a person." "It is not so easy to forget that his blood and mine make us more than sons born to the same father," the borderman declared gloomily. "I cannot ignore nor forget such strong ties." Durin and Dale looked at each other, unable to comprehend what the two were talking about. They knew that Balinor had a brother, but they had never seen him, and had heard no mention of him since they had begun the long journey from Cullhaven. Balinor noticed the baffled looks on the faces of the two elven brothers, and shot a quick smile in their direction. "It's not as bad as it might seem," he assured them calmly. Hendel shook his head hopelessly and lapsed into silence for the next few minutes. "My younger brother Palance and I are the only sons of Rule Buckhanna, the King of Calahorn," Balinor volunteered, his eyes wandering back toward the distant city as if looking for another time.
We were very close while growing up. As close as you two. As we got older, we developed different ideas about life. Different personalities, as all individuals must, brothers or not. I was the elder. I was next in line to the throne. Palance always realized this, of course, but it divided us as we grew older, mainly because his ideas of ruling the land were not always the same as mine. It's difficult to explain, you understand.
It's not so difficult, Hendel snorted meaningfully.
All right, then it's not so difficult, Balinor conceded wearily, to which Hendel responded with a knowing nod. Palance believes Callahorn should cease to serve as a first line of defense in case of attack on the Southland people. He wants to disband the Border Legion and isolate Callahorn from the rest of the Southland. We cannot agree at all on this point. He trailed off in bitter silence for a moment. Tell them the rest, Balinor. Hendel again spoke icily. My distrustful friend believes my brother is no longer his own master, that he says these things without meaning them. He keeps counsel with a mystic known as Stenman, a man Alanon feels is without honor and will guide Palance to his own destruction. Stenman has told my father and the people that my brother should rule and not I. He has turned him against me. When I left, even Palance seemed to believe that I was not fit to rule Callahorn.
And that scar? Dieran asked quietly.
An argument we had just before I left with Alanon, Balinor replied, shaking his head as he thought back on the matter. I can't even remember how it started. But all at once, Palance was in a rage. There was real hatred in his eyes. I turned to leave and he grabbed a whip from the wall, striking out at me, cutting into my face with the tip. That was the reason I decided to get away from Tirsis for a time, to give Palance a chance to regain his senses. If I had stayed after that incident, we might have... Again he trailed off ominously, and Hendel shot the elven brothers a glance that left no doubt in their minds what would have happened if the brothers had had another altercation. Dieran frowned in disbelief, wondering what sort of person would take sides against a man like Balinor. The tall borderman had repeatedly proved his courage and strength of character during their dangerous journey to Perrinor, and even Alanon had relied heavily on him. Yet his brother had deliberately and vindictively turned against him. The elf felt a deep sadness for this brave warrior, returned to a homeland where peace even in his own family was denied him. You must believe me when I tell you that my brother was not always like that. Nor do I believe he is now a bad man, Balinor continued, more as if he were explaining it to himself than to the others. This mystic Stenman has some kind of hold over Palance that provokes him into these rages, turning him against me and what he knows to be right. There is more to him than that, Hendel interrupted sharply. Palance is an idealistic fanatic. He seeks the throne and turns against you under pretext of upholding the interests of the people. He is choking on his own self-righteousness.
Perhaps you are right, Hendel, Balinor conceded quietly. But he is still my brother, and I love him.
That's what makes him so dangerous, the dwarf declared, standing before the tall borderman, meeting his gaze squarely. He no longer loves you. Balinor did not reply, but stared into the plainlands to the west and toward the city of Tirsis. The others remained silent for a few minutes, leaving the brooding prince to his own thoughts. Finally he turned back to them, his face relaxed and calm, looking as if the whole matter had never come up. Time to be moving on. We want to reach the walls of the city before nightfall.
I'm going no farther with you, Balinor, Hendel interjected quickly. I must return to my own land and help prepare the dwarf armies against an invasion of the Anar.
Well, you can rest in Tirsis for tonight and leave tomorrow, Dale replied quickly, knowing how tired they all were and anxious for the dwarf's safety.
Hendel smiled patiently, then shook his head.
No, I must travel at night in these lands. If I stay the night in Tirsis, I lose a whole day's travel, and time is very precious to us all. The entire Southland stands or falls on how quickly we can assemble our armies into a combined fighting unit to strike back at the Warlock Lord. If Shae and the Sword of Shannara are lost to us, then our armies are all we have left. I will travel to Varfleet and rest there. Take care, my friends. Luck to you in the days ahead.
And to you, brave Hendel. Balinor extended a great hand. Hendel clasped it warmly, then those of the elven brothers, and disappeared into the forests with a parting wave. Balinor and the elven brothers waited until they could no longer see him moving through the trees, and then began their walk across the plains toward Tirsis. The sun had dropped behind the horizon, and the sky had turned from dusky red to a deep gray and blue that signaled the momentary approach of night. They were about halfway when the sky turned completely black, revealing the first of the night's stars shining in a clear, cloudless sky. As they neared the fabled city, its vast bulk sprawling and dark against the night horizon, the Prince of Calahorn described in detail to the elven brothers the history behind the building of Tirsis. A series of natural defenses protected the man-made fortress. The city had been built on a high plateau which ran back against a line of small but treacherous cliffs. The cliffs bounded the plateau entirely on the south and partially on the west and east. While they were not nearly so high or formidable in appearance as the Dragon's Teeth or the Charnel Mountains of the far Northland, they were incredibly steep. That portion of the cliffs that faced north onto the plateau rose almost straight up, and no one had ever successfully scaled it. Thus the city was well protected from the rear, and it had never been necessary to construct any defenses to the south. The plateau on which the city was built was a little over 3 miles across at its widest point, dropping off sharply onto the plainlands, which ran unbroken and open all the way north and west to the Myrmidon River, and east to the forests of Calahorn. The swift Myrmidon actually formed the first line of defense against invasion, and few armies had ever gotten beyond that point to reach the plateau and the city walls. The enemy who did manage to cross the Myrmidon onto the plainlands immediately found itself confronted by the steep wall of the plateau, which could be defended from above. The main route of access to this bluff was a huge iron and stone rampway, which was rigged to collapse by knocking out pins in the major supports. But even if the enemy managed to reach the top of the plateau and thereby gain a foothold, the third defense waited. The defense that no army had ever broken through. Standing a scant 200 yards from the edge of the plateau and ringing the entire city in a semicircle, the ends reaching back to the cliff sides protecting the southern approach, was the monstrous outer wall. Constructed from great blocks of stone welded together with mortar, the surface had been smoothed down to make scaling by hand virtually impossible. It rose nearly 100 feet into the air, massive, towering, impregnable. At the top of the wall, ramparts had been built for the men fighting within the city, with sections cut away to allow concealed bowmen room to shoot down on the unprotected attackers. It was ancient in styling, crude and rough-hewn, but it had repelled invaders for almost 1,000 years. No enemy army had penetrated into the inner city since its construction following the First War of the Races. Just within the great outer wall, the Border Legion was quartered in a series of long, sloping barracks, interspersed by buildings used for storage of supplies and weapons. Approximately one-third of this great fighting force was kept on duty at any given time, while the other two-thirds remained at home with their families, pursuing their secondary occupations as laborers, craftsmen, or shopkeepers in the city. The barracks were equipped to house the entire army if the need should ever arise, as indeed it had already done on more than one occasion, but at present they were only partially filled. Set back from the barracks, supply housing and parade grounds was a second wall of stone blocks separating the soldiers' quarters from the city proper. Within this second wall, lining the neat, winding city streets, were the homes and businesses of the urban population of Tirsis, all carefully constructed and meticulously cared for buildings. The city sprawled over most of the plateau's elevation, running from this second stone wall almost to the cliffs bordering the south approach. At this innermost point of the city, a low third wall had been built which marked the entrance to the government buildings and the royal palace of the king, complete with public forum and landscaped grounds. The tree-shaded parks surrounding the palace provided the only sylvan setting on the otherwise open and sparse flatland of the plateau. The third wall had not been built for defensive purposes, but as a line of demarcation, signifying government-owned property that had been reserved for the king's use, and, in the case of the parks, for all the people. Balinor deviated from his description of the city's construction long enough to point out to the elven brothers that the kingdom of Calahorn was one of the few remaining enlightened monarchies in the world. While it was technically a monarchy ruled by a king, the government also consisted of a parliamentary body composed of representatives chosen by the people of Calahorn, who helped the ruler hammer out the laws that governed the land. The people took great pride in their government and in the border legion in which most either had served at one time or were serving now. It was a country in which they could be free men, and this was something worth fighting for. Calahorn was a land that reflected both the past and the future. On the one hand, its cities had been built primarily as fortresses to withstand the frequent assaults by warlike neighbors. The Border Legion was a carryover from earlier times when the newly formed nations were constantly at war, when an almost fanatical pride in national sovereignty resulted in a long struggle over jealously guarded land boundaries, when brotherhood between the peoples of the four lands was still only a distant possibility. The rustic, old-fashioned decor and architecture could be found nowhere else in the quickly growing cities of the deep Southland. Cities where more enlightened cultures and less warlike policies were beginning to prevail. Yet it was Tirsis, with her barbaric walls of stone and warrior men of iron, that had shielded the lower Southland and given it that chance to expand in new directions. There were signs of what was to come in this picturesque land as well, signs that told of another age and time not too far distant. There was a unity of expression in the people that spoke of tolerance and understanding of all races and peoples. In Calahorn, as in no other country in all the sheltered Southland, a man was accepted for what he was and treated accordingly. Tirsis was the crossroads of the four lands, and through its walls and lands passed members of all the nations, giving its people an opportunity to see and understand that the differences in face and body that distinguished the races outwardly were negligible. It was the inner person the people had learned to judge. A giant rock troll would not be stared at and shunned because of his grotesque appearance by the people of Calahorn. Trolls were common in that land. Gnomes, elves, and dwarves of all types and species made regular passages through that country, and if they were friends, they were welcomed. Balinor smiled as he spoke of this new, growing phenomenon that had begun at last to spread to all the lands, and he felt proud that his people were among the first to turn from the old prejudices to look for common grounds of understanding and friendship. Durin and Dale listened in silent agreement.
The elven people knew what it was like to be alone in a world of people who couldn't see beyond their own limits.
Balinor had finished, and the three comrades swung from the tall grass of the plainland onto a broad roadway. The road wound ahead into the darkness toward the low, squat plateau looming blackly against the horizon. They were close enough now to make out the lights of the sprawling city and the movement of people on the stone ramp. The entrance through the towering outer wall was sharply outlined by torchlight, the giant gates standing open on oiled hinges, guarded by a number of dark-garbed sentries. From the courtyard within shone the lights of the barracks, but there was an absence of men's laughter and joking that Balinor found peculiar. The voices that were audible were hushed, even muffled, as if no one wished to be heard. The tall borderman peered ahead watchfully, suddenly concerned that something was amiss. But he could detect nothing out of the ordinary, aside from the unusual silence. He dismissed the matter from his mind. The elven brothers followed wordlessly as the determined Balinor mounted the causeway leading to the darkened bluff. Several people passed them as they climbed, and those who looked carefully turned to stare in open shock at the Prince of Callahorn. Balinor failed to acknowledge these strange looks, intent upon the city ahead, but the brothers missed nothing and looked at each other in silent warning. Something was seriously wrong. Moments later, as the three reached the plateau, Balinor too stopped in sudden concern. He peered intently toward the gates of the city, then looked about him at the shadowed faces of the people passing, who scattered quickly and wordlessly into the night upon discovering his identity. For a moment the three stood rooted in silence, watching the few remaining passers-by disappear into the darkness, leaving them alone.
"What is it, Balinor?" Durin asked at last.
"I'm not certain," the prince replied anxiously.
"Look at the insignia of those guards at the gate.
None of them bear the crest of the leopard, the standard of my border legion. Instead, they wear the sign of a falcon, a mark I do not recognize.
The people, too. Did you notice their looks?" The slim elven faces nodded as one, the keen, slanted eyes casting about in undisguised apprehension.
"No matter," the borderman declared shortly. "This is still my father's city, and these are my people. We'll get to the bottom of this when we reach the palace."
Again he started toward the mammoth gates of the outer wall, the elves a step or two behind him. The tall prince made no effort to hide his face as he approached the four armed guards, and their reaction was the same as that of the astonished passers-by. They made no move to stop the prince, and no words passed between them. Yet one hurriedly abandoned his post and disappeared quickly through the gates of the inner wall into the streets of the city beyond. Balinor and the elves passed beneath the shadow of the giant gateway, which seemed to hang in the darkness above them like a monstrous stone arm. They moved past the open gates and the watchful guards into the courtyard beyond, where they could see the low, Spartan-like barracks that housed the famed Border Legion. There were few lights burning, and the barracks appeared to be nearly deserted. A few men scattered about the courtyard wore tunics bearing the insignia of the leopard, but they wore no armor and carried no weapons. One stared momentarily as the three paused in the center of the courtyard, then started in disbelief and cried out sharply to his fellow soldiers. A door burst open from one of the barracks and a grizzled veteran appeared, staring with the others at Balinor and the elven brothers. He gave a short command, and the soldiers reluctantly turned back to whatever they had been doing, while he hastened over to the three newcomers.
"My lord Balinor, you've come at last," the soldier exclaimed in greeting, his head bowing briefly as he came to attention before his commander.
"Captain Shelon, it's good to see you."
Balinor clasped the veteran's gnarled hand in his own.
"What's going on in the city? Why do the guards wear the sign of a falcon and not that of our fighting leopard?"
"My lord, the Border Legion has been ordered to disband. Only a handful of us still remain on duty.
the rest to return to their homes.
They stared at the man as if he were insane. The Border Legion had been disbanded in the midst of the greatest invasion ever to threaten the Southland?
Almost as one, they recalled the words of Al-Anon telling them that the Border Legion was the only hope left to the people of the threatened lands, that the Border Legion must at least temporarily delay the awesome force assembled by the Warlock Lord. Now the army of Callahorn had been mysteriously scattered.
By whose order? Balinor asked in slow fury.
It was your brother, the grizzled Shelon declared quickly. He ordered his own guardsmen to assume our duties and commanded the Legion to disband until further notice. The lords Acton and Messaline went to the palace to beg the king to reconsider, but they did not return. There was nothing more any of us could do but obey.
Has everyone gone mad? The infuriated borderman demanded, clasping the soldier's tunic.
What of my father, the king? Does he not still rule this land and command the Border Legion? What does he say of this fool's play?
Shelon looked away, groping for the words to the answer he was afraid to speak. Balinor jerked him around violently.
I do not know, my lord, the man muttered, still trying to turn away. We heard the king was ill, and then there was nothing more. Your brother declared himself temporary ruler in the king's absence from the throne. That was 3 weeks ago.
Balinor released the man in shocked silence and stared absently at the lights of the distant palace, the home he had come back to with such great hopes. He had left Callahorn because of an intolerable rift between his brother and himself, yet his going had only made matters worse. Now he must face the unpredictable Palance on terms not of his own choosing. Face him and persuade him somehow of the folly of his action in disbanding the desperately needed Border Legion.
We must go at once to the palace and speak with your brother.
The eager, impatient voice of Dale cut into his thoughts. He looked at the youthful elf for a moment, reminded suddenly of his own brother's young age. It was going to be so hard to reason with Palance.
Yes, you're right, of course, he agreed almost absently. We must go to him.
No, you mustn't go in there.
The sharp cry of Shelon held them rooted in place.
The others who went did not come out again. There are rumors that your brother has declared you a traitor. Found you to be in league with the evil Al-Anon, the black wanderer who serves the dark powers. It has been said that you shall be imprisoned and put to death.
That is ridiculous, exclaimed the tall borderman quickly.
I am no traitor, and even my brother knows this to be true. As for Al-Anon, he is the best friend and ally the Southland will ever find. I must go to Palance and speak with him. We may disagree, but he would not imprison his own brother. The power is not his.
Unless, perhaps, your father is dead, my friend, Durin cautioned from one side. The time to be prudent is now, before we have entered the palace grounds. Hendel believes your brother to be under the influence of the mystic Stenman, and if he is, you may be in greater danger than you realize.
Balinor paused, then nodded his agreement. Quickly he explained to Shelon the threat to Callahorn of an impending Northland invasion, emphasizing his belief that the Border Legion would be vital to the defense of their homeland. Then he gripped the aged soldier's shoulder tightly and bent close to him.
You will wait 4 hours for my return or for my personal messenger. If I have not come out or sent word in that time, you will seek out the Lords Jinison and Fandwick. The Border Legion needs to be reassembled immediately. Then go to the people and demand an open trial of our cause from my brother. He cannot refuse this. You will also send word west and east to the elf and dwarf nations, informing them that we are thus held, both I and the cousins of Eventine. Can you remember all I have said to you?
Yes, my lord.
The soldier nodded eagerly.
It shall be done as you command. May fortune go with you, Prince of Calahorn.
He turned and disappeared back into the barracks, while an impatient and angry Balinor moved toward the inner city. Once again, Durin whispered to his younger brother, urging him to remain outside the city walls until he knew what would happen to Balinor and himself, but Dale stubbornly refused to be left behind. Durin knew it was pointless to argue the matter further, and at last conceded Dale's right to go along. The slim elf had not yet reached his 20th year, and for him life was just beginning. All of the members of the little company that had come from Cullhaven had felt a special kind of affection for Dale, the protective love that close friends always feel for the youngest. His fresh candor and ready friendship were rare qualities in a time when most men lived lives hemmed in by suspicion and distrust. Durin was afraid for him, for he had the most to look ahead to and the fewest years behind. If the boy were harmed in any way, he realized that an irreplaceable part of himself would be lost. Durin watched his brother in silence as the lights of Tirsis burned through the darkness ahead. In moments, the three crossed the courtyard and passed through the gates of the inner wall to the streets of the city beyond. Once more, the guards stared in open amazement, but again they did not move to stop the travelers from entering. Balinor seemed to grow in size as the three proceeded down the Tirsian Way, the main city thoroughfare, his dark form wrapped ominously in the hunting cloak, the chainmail glinting from exposed fists and neck. He stood taller than before, no longer the weary traveler at his journey's end, but the Prince of Calahorn come home. The people knew him at once, at first stopping and staring like those at the outer gates, then gathering heart from his proud bearing and rushing after him, eager to welcome him home. The crowd swelled from a few dozen to several hundred as the favorite son of Calahorn strode boldly through the city, smiling to those who followed, but hastening to reach the palace. The shouts and cries of the people rose deafeningly, changing from scattered voices to a single rising chant, calling the tall borderman's name. A few of the crowd managed to get next to the determined man, whispering ominous warnings. But the prince would not listen to cautious voices any longer. Shaking his head after each warning, he continued on. The growing crowd passed through the heart of Tirsis, milling under the giant archways and crosswalks that ran overhead, pushing through the narrow portions of the Tirsian Way past tall, white-walled buildings and smaller single-family residences to the Bridge of Sendik, which spanned the lower levels of the people's parks. At the other end stood the gates of the palace, darkened and closed. At the peak of the bridge's wide arch, the Prince of Calahorn turned abruptly to face the throng still faithfully following him and threw up his hands in a command to halt. They came to an obedient stop, their voices lowering into silence as the tall figure addressed them. "My friends, my countrymen." The proud voice rang out in the near darkness, its thundering echoes rolling back. "I have missed this land and its brave citizens, but I have come home, and I will not leave again. There is no need for fear. This land shall stand eternal. If there be trouble within the monarchy, then it is for me to face it. You must go back now to your homes and wait for morning to show you in a better light that all is well. Please, go now to your homes, and I shall go to mine." Without waiting to judge the crowd's reaction, Balinor wheeled about and proceeded on across the bridge toward the gates of the palace, the elven brothers still close at his heels. The voice of the people rose again to call after them, but the crowd did not follow, though many might have wished to do so. Obedient to his command, they turned slowly about, some still shouting his name in defiance at the silent, darkened castle, though others mumbled grim prophecies of what awaited the tall borderman and his two friends within the walls of the imperial home. The three travelers quickly lost sight of the people as they started down the slope of the bridge's high arch in quick, determined strides. In minutes they reached the tall, metal-bound gates of the Palace of the Buckhannas. Balinor never paused, but reached for the huge iron ring fastened to the wood and brought it crashing down against the shuttered gate in thundering knocks. For a moment there was no other sound, as the men stood in the darkness without, listening with mixed feelings of anger and apprehension. Then a low voice from within called for identification. Balinor gave his name and a sharp command to those within to open the gates immediately. In an instant, the heavy bars were drawn back and the gates swung inward to admit the three. Balinor moved into the garden courtyard without a backward glance at the silent guards, his eyes on the magnificent columned building beyond. Its high windows were dark except for those on the ground floor in the left wing. Durin motioned Dale ahead of him, taking the opportunity to peer into the shadows about them where he quickly discovered a dozen well-armed guards close at hand. All bore the insignia of the Falcon. The watchful elf knew instantly that they were walking into a trap, just as he had silently anticipated when they had entered the city. His first inclination was to stop Balinor and warn him of what he had seen, but he instinctively knew that the borderman was far too seasoned a fighter not to know what he was getting into. Durin wished once more that his brother had stayed outside the palace walls, but it was too late now. The three crossed the garden walks to the doors of the palace. There were no guards, and the doors opened without resistance to Balinor's hurried shove. The halls of the aged building glowed brightly in the torchlight, the flames catching the splendor of the colorful wall murals and paintings that decorated the Buckhanna family home. The wood trimming was old and rich, polished with care and partially covered by fine tapestries and metal plaques of family crests from generations of the famed rulers of the land. As the elven brothers followed the tall prince down these silent halls, they recalled darkly another time and place in the recent past, the ancient fortress of Perenor. There, too, a trap had awaited them amid the historic splendor of another age. They turned left into another hallway, Balinor still in the lead by several strides, his big form filling the high corridor, the long hunting cloak billowing out behind him as he walked. For an instant he reminded Durin of Alanon, huge, angered, dangerous when he moved cat-like as the Prince of Callahorn did now. Durin glanced anxiously at Dale, but the younger elf did not seem to notice. His face was flushed with excitement. Durin felt for the handle of his dagger, the cold metal reassuring to his hot palm. If they were to be trapped again, it would not be without a fight. Then the giant borderman stopped suddenly before an open doorway. The elven brothers hastened to his side, peering past his broad frame into the lighted room beyond. There was a man standing near the back of the elegantly furnished chamber. A big man, blonde and bearded, his broad figure cloaked in a long purple robe with a falcon marking. He was several